Bloomberg News on demand.
This Bloomberg podcast is brought to you by Allianz. Visit Allianz.com. Allianz, financial solutions from A to Z.
Bloomberg on the Economy with Tom Keene. Wednesday, December 31st, 2008.
Richard Zehr Wilbur, professor in natural science at Stanford University. Our theme for 2008 has been the economics of food. We end the year with the science of molecular collision processes, translated the chemistry of the bubbles in tonight's champagne. Also Zehr on vintage versus non-vintage, the Pinot Noir in your rosé, and the miracle that is on food and cooking, the science and lore of the kitchen. Let's cut to the chase. 1994, McGee and Zehr do some research. Professor, I'm shocked at the bottom of this research note. Quote, as usual, more research is needed, and the observations we have made open more questions about the bubbles in the champagne. Industrial sponsorship is sought. This was serious chemistry on why the bubbles in champagne do what they do, wasn't it?
It was great fun, as well as something that intrigues us. You know, it's important to realize that the whole world is has aspects of science involved in it. It's in part of everyday life, and it certainly is in champagne, such as trying to understand the nature of the bubbles in champagne, what makes bubbles, how they rise, why they change their shape as they rise, etc. And one of the questions, of course, that people had was, how do you keep champagne from going?
Does the silver spoon work?
to a small extent, but the real thing that works is keeping it cold, keeping your champagne cold. The faster you can return it to the refrigerator, even if you don't cork it, you will keep the gas inside. The gas is carbon dioxide, and its solubility, how much it goes into the liquid, depends on temperature. Everyone knows if you take water and you boil it, it tastes flat. The same thing happens to soda pop, right? You drive the gas out with temperature. If you keep it cold, you keep the gas inside.
It's a boom business now. I was surprised in our research, Professor, how new champagne is. I really didn't realize how 19th century and 20th century it is. Is that because the chemistry had to catch up with what people were trying to do?
Well, it's fascinating. It, of course, started in France in the Champagne area. And it was a trick, if I might term it that way, of how to take somewhat inferior white wine and make it quite delectable. And it was found that by letting it go ahead and ferment, the fermentation process producing not only ethyl alcohol, okay, what we call alcohol, but producing carbon dioxide, that's the bubbles that we get, that indeed you could produce this effervescent mixture, which people enjoy so much. Champagne belongs to that particular area, and there are other countries who have done similar things, such as in Italy, it's, I think, called Prosecco, and so forth. But there's a lot of wonderful carbonated beverages of that sort, sparkling wines, as well as other sparkling drinks. Doesn't need to be necessarily alcoholic.
Well, we did a lot of research here at Bloomberg in preparation for this, trying to find those that could tell the difference between Dom Perignon and Prosecco. And one, Mr. Friedman in Bloomberg News, was able to make that distinction. He was pretty sure he could make it. They used to wear iron masks when they bottled it, because the bottling process was so dangerous with the bottles exploding and they didn't want to get glass in their faces. When did they figure out the actual physical science of containing the bubbles? Is that a recent phenomenon, or is that older?
Again, it actually had to do with glass blowing and understanding that you should make the bottle come to a very small opening so that the pressure, which is the force per unit area, is actually less that way on the cork because you have less area, okay, in terms of the force.
Yeah, that's fine.
And same pressure, but a different force.
And one thing I was unclear on is the etching of the bottles on the inside. Do they do that on purpose?
I don't know much about that, actually. Etching of bottles on the inside.
That was to make the bubbles be more bubblier.
That's right. It turns out that it's interesting. The bubbles want to form on asperities, on sharp points of one sort or another, whether you actually have a scratch on your glass, which you'll notice that produces bubbles, or if you get lint from cleaning your glass, actually with a cloth, these are what form the bubbles. My good friend, Gerard Leger-Belair, who's written a wonderful book called Uncorked, I recommend it, has told me that he's actually made a glass that is so perfect that when you pour champagne into it, it doesn't bubble.
It doesn't bubble at all.
Absolutely
fascinating.
Now, I don't think I'd recommend that for New Year's Eve. I enjoyed the bubbles. Sorry.
Well, that's very good. Can you tell the difference between a California and a French champagne?
I'm not sure I'm able to have such a fine palate to make our nose to make these distinctions.
When you look at the research you've done, I've been dying to ask you this question. A snowflake, they're all different. Is a bubble, or within the chemistry, do you end up with an original bubble to Moët versus original bubble to Laurent Perrier, or one of those? I mean, are they all distinctive, or is a bubble a bubble?
Well, it depends at what level you look. If you look at the actual coating of what's outside the bubble, the skin of the bubble, that tends to be a little different for each one, okay? But the bubbles themselves all want to go round, become spherical. And why is that? Because really, this is minimizing the surface tension of the water that it's pushing apart. Okay, if for the same volume, the minimum surface area is per sphere. And rather take a cube, compare it to a sphere, you have more volume, more surface area on a cube than you do on the same amount of volume as a sphere. And water loves water. It actually crushes bubbles if it can. That's why actually bubbles don't form in the middle of water. This is true when you go to boil water on a, in a pan. If you look, the bubbles never form in the water itself. They form on the edges, on the sides of the pan, on the bottom of the pan, and they form particularly where there's scratches, right? You've seen that effect. The same thing going on in champagne. The carbon dioxide has been put into the liquid under higher pressure. There's a lot of carbon dioxide in the liquid. It wants to come out. It doesn't know how to come out. It somewhat reminds me of clouds that want to rain and don't know how to themselves form rain. You have a similar effect. It needs something to make the bubble form. Incidentally, you can actually create the bubbles. I don't recommend this in terms of a drink, but it's great fun to see. If you pour a little bit of salt into your champagne or any carbonated beverage, you'll immediately get fizz and foam. And the most dramatic example of that is adding Mentos to something like one of the carbonated beverages like Diet Coke, which is a great fun to do, something that should be done outside.
When you're blindfolded, can you tell the difference between a rosé? Within all the marketing of champagne, can you really tell a difference?
I have to confess about myself. I cannot tell much the difference. There are people who probably can. But I'm giving you my my abilities. They're limited. Sorry.
How do you open a bottle of champagne? Within talking
carefully
to Harold McGee and others, I know carefully is a correct name, but I mean, we still have the wire on. Do we need the wire today, or is it
again? You have so much pressure inside the bottle. In fact, I wonder if you've ever noticed that when you pop the cork on the bottle, there actually is like a white smoke that comes out of the bottle. I hope people have seen this.
That is actually
not smoke, but actually condensed water. It's what all San Franciscans love. It's fog. And this is coming about because we go from high pressure inside the bottle to low pressure outside the bottle. And this expansion of pressure is a cooling action.
Do you let the cork go, or do you go very slowly, like you see them doing the
fancy restaurants? I actually myself prefer to go slowly.
So do I. Now, some people like to pop the cork.
Fire the cork. I know that for celebratory purposes, sports events and celebrations for people who get a PhD, they want to fire the cork and as far as possible, et cetera.
One of the things I noticed, I want to get back to this, Professor, is the idea that 150 years ago, you could lose 20, 30, 40% of your cellar when the bottle started popping. That doesn't happen anymore, does it?
Well, unfortunately, it does happen, at least with people who, like me, are amateur beer makers. I've done some beer brewing and had one bottle go and then, like a chain reaction, take out the neighboring bottles. So there are problems this way. You have to be careful.
Well, let's switch gears to beer. Well, tell me about about the bubbles in beer? I mean, do you pour into the glass or do you pour on the edge and not let the bubbles work? Does it matter to the taste of the beer that the bubbles are there or the bubbles are not there?
It does. And let me suggest to everyone to try something. If you will, look at what we call the head on the beer. Look at the bubbles in the beer and taste them. There actually are more bitter than the beer itself. In fact, they are a purifying process that takes out some of the bitterness of the beer from the hops. And try it, and you'll see what I'm talking about.
I admit that I've actually done that, and of course our beer experts here, Ken Filiu and Charles Vollmer, both they're nodding their heads saying, yes, we've done that. That's very good. What's the trick to making homemade beer? I mean, is it about the bubbles? Is it about the yeast? Is it about the ingredients? You know, forget about the marketing and the horses and all that. What is the secret to basement beer?
The secret is perseverance and the enjoyment of actually making something work. And I enjoy cooking as a form of chemistry that is one of the few that you can go along and taste as you go along. I don't recommend that for other chemical processes.
Do they still rotate the bottles in champagne? I mean, you see in the movies, they go down and they turn them a quarter and yes. The yeast and all that. Do they still do that over a 1 year or 3 year time frame?
I'm afraid I don't know, but I think they do. I've seen, again, pictures that show that.
What about the length of time of brewing? I read a little bit about this. There's non-vintage versus vintage and all that, and the length of time. Do you buy the chemistry of a longer sitting for the bottles?
I know that there are people who do this, and I know it's particularly important with regard to wines in terms of picking up some of the flavors from the cork, if you use cork. In the process. That's also true of other things that are made.
What else do we need to know about bubbles? I mean, within the recreation of an intoxication of liquors and wines,
let me mention one thing which may be amusing. You know, vive la différence. Do you know that generally women leave less bubbles in their glass of champagne than men do? And you might say, what possibly can be the difference?
I don't know where this is going. This sounds interesting. Continue, Professor. How is it possible that women leave less? How, pray tell, is it that those lovely leave less bubbles in their champagne?
This comes about actually from lipstick. The lipstick breaks up the bubbles. The same way that if you add soap to a glass and you don't clean it out when you wash it, a beer glass, and then you pour beer back into it, you don't get a head of beer on the beer that you've poured into a soapy glass, okay? The same thing happens when you sip champagne if you are wearing lipstick, and it tends to break up the bubbles. It's easy to demonstrate that. Now, of course, these things don't always work, and it is possible, just as you can get secondhand smoke, to get secondhand lipstick. So it's also possible that men will also destroy the bubbles. This is something that can be checked out on New Year's Eve.
Professor, how do you make chemistry interesting? It's the bane of so many people. How do you fire up a freshman college or a junior year in high school? What does it take to get people fired up about chemistry?
It only takes a matter of getting people to wonder about the world and appreciate it, just as we've been talking about bubbles. There's so many things that are of interest. I want to take this opportunity, Tom, if I might, to become a bit more serious about some threats to the United States.
Sure.
And I'm going to speak to you about the fact that during the 20th century, the United States became the wealthiest nation in the world, providing one of the highest standards of living for its people. No question.
No question about that.
Okay. And whereas many nations, including rich ones, educated only those who could personally afford to attend school, the United States offered public schooling to its masses. It did that, you know, in primary, grade school, secondary, high school.
Or the land-grant program coming out of World War
II. Yeah. And in 1900, the average American had almost 9 years of schooling. By 1950, the number had increased to about 14 years. And this investment, I think, in human capital really paid off handsomely. America's educational edge over Europe and Asia boosted its productivity and prosperity. But the growth of American education system somehow starts to stagnate in the 1970s. And although we can still boast of having most of the best research universities in the world, America's primary and secondary education system is looking to be increasingly, I would say, dysfunctional. Can you imagine my grief to learn that only about 1 in 4 kindergartners, let's turn it around, that 3 in 4 kindergartners in my state of California will actually graduate high school. 1 in 4 will not. And then worse than that, about half the people who go to the California State University system, which is our biggest supplier of people who graduate college, won't finish college.
Well, from your perspective, and this has been a great theme of the program, I'm so happy you bring this up, Professor. From your perspective, a lot of money is thrown at it. The elite and those fortunate enough to attend those schools are putting out many tens of thousands of dollars, indeed hundreds of thousands of dollars per child. But what is the catalyst to move it forward, whether it's the shows we've done on very young education, 3 years old, or at that difficult sixth grade level, at the high school level, or even at the collegiate level? How do we jumpstart this process to improvement?
You know, we are spending more money than many nations in this, and we're getting less return. It's really sad. If you look at some countries in Scandinavia, Finland, Sweden, and so on, they spend much less money per capita, and they have a better return in terms of having an educated populace. How did this come about? Why? And if you look, part of it is an attitude of the culture as to whether or not teachers are valued and whether or not education is valued. And we have to somehow address that in terms of our future. And it certainly, as you know, with our financial downturn, time to take stock where we've been going and where we might be.
What would be your prescription to the new president? What is a catalyst here besides another program, another wall of money, if we need behavioral changes just in the basic idea of math education, which is not cool? How do you change that if you're having a cup of coffee with President Obama?
Well, I'm actually involved now in a task force that the American Chemical Society is putting together, and we're trying to come up with recommendations as to what to do. One of the areas that I'm personally excited about is the possibility of getting people who are already professionally trained to become science coaches in grade schools and in high schools. Let me, if I might, just explain to you why what this is about.
Tell us about these mentors.
Okay. I think mentoring makes a huge difference. I know if you look back, everybody who's been successful in somewhere points to some teacher or some event that made a huge difference.
That would be true.
At least I find that to be the case. No one tells you that it was based on a great exam that they went into a field. I'm sorry. Exams are not what it's about. You can test all you want. That does not change the system. Sorry. It is instead something which fires people up about that they can do it with their hands and think about it with their mind. Okay? And that combination seems to turn people on. That's what I find. And I think there are people who would very happily volunteer some of their time to talk with people who think they might be interested in science of one sort or another, and whether this is science fairs or independent research outside the classroom or in the classroom or whatever, I think there's a big opportunity here.
Within chemistry, and I'm speaking, folks, here with a modest knowledge, I mean, I don't think I ever got molarity, but, for those a little bit older, they'll remember the angst of Leninger's biochemistry or Morrison and Boyd in organic chemistry and, benzene rings and these other scary things. What's the Zaire answer? Is it more lab or more classroom? Less lab, less classroom. What's that weighting within a physical science?
My own answer is it's that teachers, it isn't a matter of what information you transmit. It's a matter of inspiration, not information. So teachers need to inspire, not to inform. You can get informed all you want from the internet. Okay, even better generally than teachers, I'm sorry to say. But inspiration comes from this type of contact that causes people to really wonder about things and look into things. Anything that leads to an investigation on one's part, whatever it is, okay, I think it goes on to cause people to become quite serious about maybe I can contribute to understanding the world.
What's the exciting area right now in chemistry? What's the thing, if you go to the American Chemical Society meetings, what's the hot topic right now?
Well, There really are more than one hot topic. If I might, there really are several directions that really excite people. One of them is to understand the chemical basis for life processes. We are getting down to, if you see the advances that are going on, like what we call in biology, they are on the molecular basis.
Mm-hmm.
It's understanding the world of molecules and what they do, from finding new drugs that will fight the disease to finding ways in which we can modify and improve our standard of living, our ability to enjoy things.
We mentioned at the top of the show, Professor Harold McGee, I was reading on food and cooking the other day, and we thank Mr. McGee for really kicking off our food coverage here at Bloomberg on the Economy. What a terrific book, linking in what you do, Professor, the chemistry of it, the process of it, and all of food, whether it's bread or vodka or vegetables. It's a miraculous book. Does it make you a better cook to know more about the science and the processes?
Oh, I think it does. No, and you have a better understanding how to make a hollandaise sauce or many different things as to what's going on. And it's more fun that you understand the world about you. And once again, bread, particularly with leavening, has carbon dioxide. We're once again using that process of bubbles to create things for us.
The process of bubbles. I mean, we've come a long way in 300-400 years. One of the themes here of this year's coverage of food has been so much our greater nutrition. We heard that with Angus Madison out of the United Kingdom on how even the wealthy of 400 and 500 years ago were essentially malnourished. The chemistry forward here. Are the big industrial companies and their chemistry. General Mills was in our world headquarters earlier this year. Their senior officers telling us the General Mills story. Is the chemistry of food at the industrial level still advancing forward, or is it static science?
Well, as a matter of fact, it is advancing forward. And for fun, let me make a wild prediction for you, because, you know, New Year's is always a time for predictions. My guess is 100 years from now, the people will look back at what we're eating and, in some sense, laugh and be surprised, just as in some sense we do now look back. There'll be all types of new products and new possibilities. There is some very exciting possibilities involving understanding genetic manipulation of crops as to what they might do. And while that seems to scare some people, particularly in Europe, the chances are we've been doing this. I mean, I think it's pretty clear. We've been doing this through hybrid and other things slowly for a long time. And we have now a chance to speed up this process and to make things which are much better for us. The ability, for example, to make rice in a way that allows people who eat primarily rice to be much healthier is an example of this.
What is your take on this food crisis? We're seeing percolations in our research notes this year of a difficult 2009 with grain prices higher. Do we need to jumpstart our food and our chemistry research as we did 20, 30 years ago?
We have the ability to make food for people. The real problems tend to be ones of transportation as to why we have starvation and disruptions caused by war and such. Rather than the inability to make enough food.
Thank you so much for coming on. Richard Zerfolks, Wilbur Professor, Natural Science at Stanford University.
There's more television and radio news at Bloomberg.com and at iTunes. Stream it live. Download it to your iPod or desktop. Copyright Bloomberg LP 2008.